Our latest episode of Soundtracking sees the return for the supremely entertaining writer, director and producer, Sasha Gervaisi, who joined me a couple of months ago to discuss his career to date. Now, we held some of that interview back to coincide with the release of his latest movie, My Dinner with Hervé. Starring Peter Dinklage and Jamie Dornan, My Dinner with Hervé recounts the latter days of actor Hervé Villechaize, best known for his role in smash TV show Fantasy Island and The Man with the Golden Gun, in which he played Nick Knack. As you'll hear, it's a deeply personal endeavour for Sasha, who almost by chance got to know Hervé very well shortly before he committed suicide. Before we get into that, we just wanted to say a massive thank you to the Radio Academy here in the UK for awarding us not only a bronze award, but gold in the category of Best Specialist Music Show at this year's ARIA Awards. We are extremely chuffed and are incredibly grateful to them, just as we are to you guys for listening. Speaking of award-winning podcasts, No Such Thing as a Fish is a must. Brought to us by the researchers behind the BBC TV show QI. It's a wonderful forum for barely believable yet hilarious facts in which the team present their favourite curios from the week's news with unerring charm and wit. And now they've written a book. It's called The Book of the Year 2018. And as a big fan of both No Such Thing as a Fish and QI, I'm loving it. Among the bizarre gems they've unearthed are the fact Mark Zuckerberg's private data was compromised while he was talking to Congress about compromised data, while a Belgian footballer inadvertently caused a revolution in Haiti. My personal favourite, though, is that Kim Jong-un brought his own toilet to the Singapore summit with Donald Trump so that spies couldn't use anything he left behind to analyse his health. Love it. The Book of the Year 2018 by No Such Thing as a Fish is your definitive guide to the world's weirdest news. It is out now in hardback, ebook and audiobook in all good bookshops and online. Back to this week's episode. Now, given My Dinner with Hervé was 25 years in the making, Sasha talks at length about his own relationship with Hervé and why he felt he owed it to him to get the project off the ground, which we think is a tale worth telling. So before we get to the music, we're going to share this incredible backstory with you, interspersed with extracts from composer David Norland's score. And a fine score it is too, as demonstrated by this cue, Sprinklers. Sasha, welcome back to Soundtracking. This time we can talk about Hervé, which is great. So,
My Dinner with Hervé.
Yeah, which is something that's been part of your life.
For a long time.
This man has been part of your life for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, you know, when we were going to talk about it, it's actually 25 years ago that I was sent to LA by a newspaper to do a whole slew of interviews, the least important of which was a brief interview with Hervé Villechaize. So I was sent to do a whole bunch of stuff, and you know, at the end they threw in, hey, go and do, you know, the funny guy from the Man with the Golden Gun and the Fantasy Island. And so I went, you know, with the intention of, my editor said, you know, 500 words, a few jokes, get out of there, go on to your big interview, you know. So I went to meet him, and first of all, he was one of the most compelling, charming, bizarre, sort of astonishing characters. I mean, when Hervé walked into the room, I mean, I was sitting in the chair, I was looking down at him, and he was standing right next to me. I mean, he was 3'10", and had this incredible voice, and, you know, he was clearly, something was going on with him. He was kind of lit up, and I couldn't tell whether he was drunk or medicated or both, and he was so charming and sweet. And so, you know, we had the interview, and then we went through the stories about Fantasy Island, because, you know, only 10, 12 years before, he'd been on the number one TV show in the world, Fantasy Island, Aaron Spelling. And before that, he'd done The Man with the Golden Gun, and everyone knew Knick Knack. And, you know, so he'd done these iconic roles, yeah. but you didn't really know much about him. And he was kind of a bit of a punchline in one sense. He was yeah. like, how, this isn't a real person. You know, so I was, as I was packing my stuff away, you know, we were at this place on Melrose in California, called, in LA, called Cafe Moustache. And it was in the afternoon, and we were the only people there. And I had this get in and get out to my next interview. And I was packing my stuff away, and I turned back, and he'd come around the table. He was sitting opposite me. And he had been eating this duck à l'orange with this lock knife. And he was standing there with this knife, like, near my throat. And I was like, I'm about to be shivved by the midget from Fantasy Island. I was like, what? It was just so weird.
Yeah.
It wasn't threatening. What it was he wanted to get my attention. And he said, I haven't finished yet. You know, that whole, all those stories, yeah. you've written this story. You're doing the same story that everyone does. Funny yeah. little Hervé, ha, ha, ha.
You'd written
if you want to know yeah. the real story, I'll tell you the real story. And there was something in his eyes. There was something so intense and desperate and emotional. That it just pierced my kind of cynical journalistic, you know, I've got the kind of story thing.
Yeah.
And I just started to think, well, okay, he called me out on it. I completely prejudged it. I completely had written the story before I got there. I was not allowing any kind of sense of, you know, what is this person like as a human being? So anyway, cut a long story short, I ended up rescheduling my interviews, and I spent 3 days with him. And it was the most compelling and unexpected story. And I found myself, which is quite rare, really connecting with him. You know, I was at a certain point in my life, I kind of, in a strange way, I felt how he looked. You know, I was not having a particularly good time, and he just was incredibly kind and sweet with me, mm-hmm. and so honest. And so he told me so many things about his upbringing, a lot of this stuff in his film, you know, about the family dynamics and three normal-sized brothers, and he would get attacked on the street, and, you know, really the emotional reality of what it's like to have grown up as a little person, you know, in Paris in the early 1950s, which was, you know, he would literally walk down the street and get kicked in the head. And so his father kind of gave him some money and said, go to New York, that's where all the, you know, they'll accept you and all the freaks go. And he did, and he had this incredible evolution and, you know, fell into kind of theatre, and then that led to the Bond movie, etc. But he was also an extraordinarily talented artist and painter, and I think he was still, to this day, the youngest painter to have a picture of in the Museum of Paris, I think at age 18. So he was talented, and the painting was a way for him to sort of exercise these demons of feeling other, of feeling less than, of feeling apart from, which he always was. So he told me this story, and I was completely compelled. And I remember I had these little micro cassette tapes that we had back in 1992.
Do you still have the tapes?
I still have the tapes. Well, my mum's got them somewhere in her storage. But yeah, I do, actually. So basically, I had like 15 hours of tape for 500 words. So I remember I flew home. I saw him, and we had the last time we saw each other. It was, you know, it was very emotional.
Yeah.
The last thing he said to me is actually in the film. He said, he looked at me, and we were in the Universal Sheraton where I'd gone to visit him, and he looked at me and he said, tell them I regret nothing. And it was just this incredible, oh my God, I didn't know what was going on, but you know, you just have this sense that what is going on here?
Yeah.
And I flew home to London, and I think it was 6 days later or 5 days later, I got a call from Kathy, who was his girlfriend who I'd met at that time.
Yeah.
Who was actually played by Mireille Enos very beautifully in the film.
Yeah, really lovely.
And she is an extraordinary actress, but Kathy is extraordinary. And she called to say that morning, which was Sunday the 4th of September 1993, not 1992, Hervé had committed suicide. And I just suddenly got very emotional. And I realised, like, just by some weird twist of fate, you know, some English journalist had decided to contact him as a joke. And as I listened back to the tapes, I realised that this was his will. He was telling some random stranger his story. And so my whole mentality went from doing a joke interview to writing something that I felt was really true to his life. And so I sat down and I wrote what I thought was a really strong piece of journalism from the perspective of I walked in filled with judgment and blind, yeah, and I came out having a human connection with someone extraordinary who I never would have imagined would have been,
yeah,
this type of person. And I took it into the editors and they said, this is wonderful. Unfortunately, and this was for You magazine at the time, right? They said, you know, we're 6 million people are going to choke on their chocolate croissants. You know, we can't have a suicidal dwarf and, you know, all the stuff. And so I said, well, great, I'll take it somewhere else, because I'd already lined it up to go somewhere else, because I sort of knew that they weren't,
yeah,
really going to get it, because that's not what they did, you know. And they said, no, we want the story. And I said, well, you can't have the story. They said, we flew you out there, we sent you to the interview, we own the story. Now, if you don't rewrite it, someone else will. So in the end, someone else rewrote the story, because I wanted it to be a cover story. It was a world exclusive.
You know,
it was still very famous at that time. In the end, it was rewritten and cut down significantly. I sort of did a little bit, but ultimately, you know, we got a few pages in the middle and it was just kind of, you know,
fluffy,
vanillified.
Yeah.
You know, there was some stuff in there, but it never really got all the stuff that had happened between us.
Yeah.
I said, one day I'm going to tell his fucking story. So a couple of years later, I sat down and I wrote my first ever screenplay. I had no idea what I was doing. It was a short script about a short man called My Dinner with Hervé. It was 34 pages. And it was just my attempt to tell this story. And I thought,
wow,
I'm going to tell it like a sort of epic. And that script was the thing that got me into UCLA Film School that ultimately Steven Spielberg read and started my career, ironically. But, you know, so I'd always intended to do it as a film, and several years ago I was actually going to do it after Anvil, and the truth is we just couldn't get it made, because
mm-hmm.
Peter Dinklage and I had been talking since just around The Station Agent.
Oh wow.
You know, so
I love
Peter,
that film so,
so 15, 16 years ago The Station Agent was this huge hit, and Peter,
yeah,
suddenly Peter Dinklage has arrived,
yeah,
and it becomes this indie film darling. I approached him, he said he'd been inspired by Hervé, and as a successful other, you know, like,
yeah,
different type of actor, but also just as a human being from his interesting, you know, his wonderful tapestry of adventures in life and what he'd accomplished, Peter had obviously been very aware of him,
yeah,
and felt a natural kinship, because, you know, in the film you see Hervé having experimental medical treatments. You know, Peter had a version of that later in life, so he related directly to that experience, and he really wanted to play the part. I'd done Anvil, and I really wanted to make Hervé. No one wanted to make it. Peter Dinklage, you know.
Yeah.
Who's Peter Dinklage? You know, great. He's big at Sundance. No one cares. So it was very sort of frustrating, because that's really what I wanted to do,
yeah,
you know, almost 10 years ago now. So it kind of, I had written it as a feature and it kind of languished. And then a few years ago, I came back to it and I thought, you know, it was still going to be, the original script was really all about Hervé's life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about, you know, his art career, the extraordinary stuff he'd done helping kids and charities. You know, he had an amazing life. But, you know, it suddenly dawned on me, no one really wanted to make that film. And someone said to me, look, you know, why have you kept going, you know, literally at that point for sort of 20 years on this story? What is it? And I said, well, because I kind of made a promise to this guy that I was going to tell the story and I feel like I got to do it. And they said, well, he told you, maybe he told you for a reason. And I started to think, well, that's interesting, because most people would have just given up, like,
mm-hmm,
rationally Anvil should have just given up, but they kept going. You know, why have I kept going with this story? Because I related to it. then sort of the idea formed of making it really a relationship film, so that I could then also have another big part. It was about two people as much as it was about Hervé. And in the end, that's how I wrote the script. And that was the movie that got made. That was the one that people wanted to make.
Yeah.
So it evolved over the past 20 years into that. And it's amazing what's happened, you know, as because I obviously got to know a lot about him. Knowing him in the short period I did, you know, he was so incredibly defiantly proud. I mean, the first thing he said is, "Don't call me little person, call me dwarf. And I'm a French dwarf," you know. And he was like, he was very like, "This is who I am, fuck you." You know,
he didn't
give a fuck, right? And there was something beautiful about that. And, you know, his legendary kind of stuff with women. Because there had been a rumor going around that he was so well endowed that, you know, his nickname was Tripod. You know, that was so... I actually had the good fortune to speak with Roger Moore several years ago about Hervé. I you know, met him and we chatted about Hervé, and he was very sweet about him. Because I'd heard all these stories about, you know, his outrageous behaviour during The Man with the Golden Gun. He said he was a very, very naughty little man. He said stuff like that. Because then he told crazy stories. But, you know, he said, no, the Tripod was not his nickname. So there were all these myths and legends that had built up around Hervé over the years. So many things.
And his Filipino descent, that as well.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. It's like out of nowhere, this, you know, many things. But yeah, that's one of them where... In my research for Hervé, having spoken and gotten to know his brother, Patrick, who's also in the film. Patrick's in the film. So there's a scene where Hervé is having his third or fourth birthday. And there's a butler who comes in who gives Hervé his cake. That is Hervé's real brother. Because Patrick, we reached out to Patrick. We really wanted to get, you know, we wanted the family to feel good. And I wanted, Patrick to meet Peter. And they have an amazing friendship. Because you can imagine how odd it is for Patrick that his brother's died 25 years ago. And suddenly here come these random people and Peter Dinklage to make a film about him. I think he was very touched that he would be remembered and remembered with love in the way that I think we've done. And yeah, the Filipino thing, for example, came up with him. And he's like, "What are you talking about?" And Kathy, who was his girlfriend, similarly. You know, there are many myths that have come up. And that's one of them that's just not factually true. But you know how stuff gets on the internet and people tend to believe it. But it's... You know, knowing Hervé as he was, me and Patrick were talking about it, you know, Hervé was so defiantly proud. If he actually had been Filipino, he would have been said, "I'm Filipino," you know.
Yeah.
So, but it's funny how these things happen, you know, people make a judgment and they, "Oh, he must look Filipino, he looks Filipino, let's put that on the thing." But yeah, there's many myths about Hervé, Tripod, Filipino, you know, that he did, that he was selfish and venal and a drug addict, completely untrue. You know, because I'd heard that, for example, he did tons of cocaine and drugs, you know, and both his brother and his girlfriend said, completely untrue. So it was important for us that we get, you know, the real stuff in there.
Yeah.
Recognizing also this is a film and we're trying to tell a life and a relationship in an hour and a half.
They take a Polaroid in the film and then we see the real Polaroid at the end of it. Such an emotional moment watching the film. Just his eyes, his kind of bloodshot eyes in that Polaroid sort of thing.
And that was literally, I think, 6 days before he committed suicide. So I knew something was going on. I think, you know, if I'm being honest, when I make a film, sometimes you do it because you want to work, and other times you do it because there's a sort of a personal, maybe almost sacred reason.
Yeah.
I think that's true with Hervé. I think that's true with Anvil. Both of those films end with a photo of me and the subject. I mean, I'm at the risk of sounding ridiculously egotistical, I think I'm trying to make sense of my own life. Like, why did this shit happen? Because I don't know.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea why this stuff happened. But I'm trying to kind of understand, you know, there was a reason why Hervé told me his story. There was a reason why 25 years to the month that we met... this film is now about to come out. You know, so I'm still trying to make sense of it. But to me, it's the ones I have a real personal connection with that really are the sort of, more personal, poetic films. And I'm just going to try and keep doing that because that's what we're here for, right? Mm-hmm. You know,
telling stories.
To tell the story that matters to you, that hopefully other people connect with. And I was really fortunate with Anvil that other people really connected with it. And I think that, you know, hopefully, you know, this becomes a universal story too, because we've all felt like Hervé. We've all felt less than, and the freak in the corner and the other, and whether at school or in jobs, we've all felt rejected by parents or lovers, and we've all felt the emptiness of success if we've had some, you know. And I think we're in a culture right now where, you know, it's worrying. Kids are growing up, you know, watching Instagram, which to me is just a real, it's all it is people boasting or people kind of fronting about how happy and how wonderful isn't this great, and I'm on this big yacht. And it's just kids are growing up comparing their insides to other people's outsides, and there's a spate of suicides and depressions and increased drug use, and, you know, because we're making ourselves miserable. And I think one of the points of this film is to point out you can have it all, but let me tell you, man, it's fucking empty. Like, look at what Hervé was making in 1979. Hervé was making $35,000 per week, which is about equivalent of 10 times that now. Had all the money in the world. He was famous. He was on the front cover of Time magazine. You know, he was known all over the world. Did that fix it? Absolutely not. And I think you see that with celebrities today.
Yeah.
And it's just, I just hope that people get the message, you know, that you need to earn stuff, you know, that if you're happy, it's going to be in spite of those things, not because of them. So, you know, it's sort of a little bit about the vapidity and emptiness of fame as well. You know, I'm not really preaching too much, but, you know, I'm in Hollywood, and so all around me I see people who are massively successful, famous people, and, you know, most of them are miserable because everything that they were taught or told would make them happy. Guess what? They've got it all, and it doesn't. Mm. So I think the sooner people can kind of get with that truth, the better, because all of that stuff is glittering and impressive, but, you know...
It's not real.
It's not real. You know, you can get high on it for a weekend, and then it's Monday, and then what are you going to do? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who gives a shit how big your boat is if you're a miserable motherfucker? You know? So I just, I hope that, I think Hervé learned that lesson hard. No matter what he did, no matter how famous or rich he got, it couldn't fix something that was at his core. Mm. And that is, I think, the tragedy of modern life as well. I hope, you know, that speaks to that. Anyway, I hope someone gets something from it. I certainly did.
Yeah, no, I did it too, totally. I really did. With music with the film, it's really interesting because there's in the past you've used great stuff that you've managed to get, whether it be Bowie, do you know what I mean, things like that in there as well, and you've got a My Morning Jacket track as well in November Criminals, which we haven't even talked about, but there's Needle Drops, as you know,
source
music,
source.
That's in there, that's really great, and really kind of some of those tracks as well are so kind of, they put you instantly in a play,
in that moment,
totally. Especially in clubs and things like that as well. And then that working in unison as well with the score, was that easy to achieve?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, obviously I wanted an orchestral score, and, you know, there was so much emotion and sadness and this sort of very desperate and tenuous connection between these two human beings at a certain point.
Yeah.
And then ultimately this real identification and this bond and this friendship. And it just felt to David Norland and I, the composer, that, you know, that strings would have to play a large part in that. but also you're telling a story which is, you know, late 70s LA, you know, early 90s London.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got a lot of pop, and you want to bring up 1978. And for example, one of the big needle drops was there's a quite obscure number one single by Leif Garrett. I can't even remember the name of it. I always confuse it with the Kiss song, I Was Made for Loving You, which is also in the film. I Was Made for Dancing by Leif Garrett.
And the
reason why I Was Made for Dancing was because Leif Garrett had the same kind of fame that Hervé did.
He
was a teen idol, 77, 78. He had a couple of number one hits. He was big for like 2 years in the way that Hervé was between 79 and 81. Massive number one idol, and then evaporated. You know, it was so, to me, the use of that song was sort of also telling the story. It was saying, okay, this is this kind of fame.
Yeah.
Which is so kind of fragile and so flavor of the month. And there's something dangerous about that.
Yeah.
But it really works for that era. Liked our movie and wanted to be involved, we were able to get some extraordinary source cues into the film, and people just giving us, you know, the music, basically, because we didn't have a lot. By the end of a film, you have no money, right?
Yeah.
And you know, when you do a budget, the guy doing the budget always puts like nothing in for music.
Going,
they'll give you more money later. And, you know, of course, they never do.
Yeah.
And so you're just like, oh great, what am I going to do? So it was again same thing with Anvil. It was like something quite different.
Yeah.
You know, in Anvil's case, it was sort of heavy metal absurdity versus kind of Sigur Rós inspired kind of dissonant, ambient, Eno-esque sort. And in this case, it was, you know, emotional strings with, you know, quite poppy and sort of upbeat and kitschy source, because, you know, Fantasy Island was kitsch. I mean, as you'll remember from the movie, Andy Garcia is Ricardo Montalban, and he brings such a sort of ludicrous kitsch to it.
Suave kitsch, it's amazing.
But what makes it work, I think, is that he's completely earnest, and he took it very seriously, and it works, I think, so well.
Mm.
So you've got kitsch, but you've also got real emotion,
mm.
you know, but the other way around to Anvil. And I wanted to, but I think that some of the source cues.
Yeah,
you
like
know, we were lucky.
It's bookended with this wonderful version of Fly Me to the Moon.
That's right, by Doris Day. And originally, we were going to use Julie London, and she actually appears in the art school scene. We have the Julie London version of Fly Me to the Moon. But I just love this Doris Day that begins, yeah, you're right, the movie begins with it, and there's something sort of so delicate and sweet and romantic, but very sad.
Mm-hmm.
And the film is hopefully those things.
Yeah.
It's very romantic and very sad and pure and emotional. You know, that's what we were going for.
Fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, darling, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Thank you. one hand, you've got Doris Day. On the other hand, you've got Kiss, I Was Made for Loving You, which was Kiss's sellout disco song, number one from 1979, yeah. Which is just utterly appalling. But
right on
wonderful.
Time through the 90s.
Yes, then we have the 90s. We have Black Box Ride on Time in that scene in the dance club. Really some quite iconic songs.
Yeah, totally.
And across the board. That's the whole thing, is this movie, tonally, is across the board.
Specifically, because you are kind of, you know, you're, there's different eras that you're in within the film, it's such a brilliant way of kind of going, I'm there. I'm in, you know, I'm in the 90s. Yeah, it's just really clever because you instantly know where you are.
Like the Hooked on Beethoven, the Hooked on Beethoven.
Yeah.
You know, that was it Walter Murphy? I can't remember, but it's da-da-da-da. That thing. It was like, it's such a ridiculous song, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
You know, for that, to taking you back to that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had an absolutely brilliant music supervisor called Evian Clean, and also Janet, who works with him. The two of them were phenomenal. We worked very well, me, David, and those guys.
Yeah.
I think we did a really good job, given that we had no budget.
Yeah.
We just had to literally call and plead and beg and, you know, make it happen.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you've done what you promised. With, you know, that promise you made him of telling a story, you've done it. And it's done beautifully. So congratulations.
I think I just got silent there. I don't know what happened. Yeah, I feel like I've dispatched my karmic duty somehow with this film, yeah.
It's great. What's next? I saw, you're talking about...
There is
nothing next. I saw How to Marry a Millionaire.
Oh, God. No,
which
that was
really exciting.
Again, another myth of
there
the
internet.
There we go.
Fake news alert.
Yeah, fake news. I mean, there's lots of fake news on the internet. I think that was something that I wrote 10 years ago. I did a draft of it, never got made, you know. There's many things out there that, again, not true. Just like the whole business we discussed before, you know. And it's... I mean, actually, Hervé is English, French, Italian and German. That is his actual lineage.
Yeah.
That's the fact. And How to Marry a Millionaire did not get made. So I wrote a draft of it. So yeah, there's a few things I'm percolating on, but I haven't really figured out what I'm doing next. I think this is a sort of natural rest point in my career life. It's like chapter one.
Mm-hmm.
Having made this film that I've wanted to for 25 years, it is a time for reflection and thinking. And you know, I have a very crazy idea that I'm sort of noodling on, but I'm not rushing.
Okay.
Until
don't take 25 years.
I won't. No. I mean, I got to work, man. I got bills to pay. I got skateboards to buy. I got stuff to do. I need a new drum kit. So.
There's a wonderful, you know, obviously the time you spent in real life with Harvey and the character that Jamie plays in the film. There's obviously part of you in that character.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, but it's, you know, the movie is inspired by real events, which means that the basic situation is the same, but a lot of the details, which is why Jamie plays a character called Danny Tate. He's sort of half me, but half someone else. Yeah. I mean, if it was me, I would just use my name, but you know, it's a character, so a lot of the details are quite different.
Sasha, thank you so much for your time. Come back for a third sitting maybe sometime.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thanks, Edith. Tonight, I want to give it all to you. In the darkness, there's so much I want to do. And tonight, I want to lay it at your feet. Girl, I was made for you. Girl, you were made for me. I was made for loving you, baby. You were made for loving me. And I can't get enough of you, baby. Can you get enough of me? Tonight, I wanna see it in your eyes.
As featured in My Dinner with Hervé, that I Was Made for Loving You by Kiss, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Sasha Gervaisi. And there was you thinking we weren't going to play it. My huge thanks to Sasha for his time. My Dinner with Hervé is airing on Sky Atlantic in the UK, having premiered on HBO. Seek it out on whatever platform you can. Now, we'll put up a link to a Spotify playlist for this show at edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And don't forget to check out the Book of the Year 2018 by our fellow podcasters, No Such Thing as a Fish, which is out now on ebook, audiobook and hardback in all good bookshops. Next up, someone else you'll find in all good bookshops, the one and only Irvin Welsh. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.